Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I've been covering health, food, and the environment for over two decades. You can find my posts on my blog, healthjournalistblog.com, as well as on the Huffington Post, Alternet, and other outlets. And every year, every week, it's actually been for several years now, about 3 years, on Connect the Dots, we bring you all of the things that connect with all the different facets of our personal health to our total health environment. You know, for many years I wrote prescriptions for well-being and self-care. I still follow them, still agree with them, still feel that there is so much that we can all do as individuals to empower our health. And yet there are many things that are going on in our communities, in our society, in our global ecology that need our help and support to assure both rights to the prerequisites for life as well as human rights and humane and caring treatment, and the way we do businesses, the way our public policies work, the way we make our priorities and our decisions in our lives and in our businesses and in our communities, all can impact health. And every week on Connect the Dots, I discuss this, different facets of this with different authors, advocates, experts, scientists, authors, all kinds of different people to bring, to shine a light on different areas in our total health spectrum. I'm very excited for today's show, where we have a wonderful guest discussing a topic that we have not really given much coverage to here on Connect the Dots. It's something I'm still in the process of learning about, and we'll learn a lot more today. Before I introduce her, I just want to give a special shout out to Mary Ellen Pursuit. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. This is a Facebook friend of mine, someone with whom I've been in exchange and dialogue and sharing of information from and advocacy from quite a few years now, and she has done what people sometimes do, which is alert me to interesting issues and people who have interesting insights into them that you know could inform all of us here on Connect the Dots. And so it's Mary Ellen's birthday, and this show is her recommendation and pick. So happy birthday, Mary Ellen, and thank you for all the great work you do. Mary Ellen introduced me to today's guest. She's an extraordinary woman with a really fascinating history, and who's really doing important breakthrough leadership work in the field of national mental health advocacy. Her name is Leah Ida Harris. She's also a mom and a writer working on what sounds like it's going to be an absolutely fascinating book entitled Trauma Nation, How to Truly Address the Roots of Violence, Suicide, and Suffering in America. The book is not out yet, still a work in progress, but you can find many of the blogs kind of putting forth the ideas that she will be putting into the book and which we will discuss on today's show, and we'll talk a little bit later about how you tune into that. You know, I think, Leah, welcome, first of all, to Connect the Dots, and we're so glad for the work you're doing and happy to have you here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
You know, one of the things I think that happens, as in many areas that we look at in the health spectrum that we cover here on the show and that I cover in my own journalism, you know, very often, you know, there's kind of a sunny, light side of, you know, what we can positively do and be joyful and, you know, kind of things we can do to nurture ourselves and nurture our health. And I think that's very important, particularly in times like these. But really to have a true picture of health, a really inclusive and holistic approach to protecting health, we really sometimes need to look at things that people want to relegate to a side corner, a side issue, say it's kind of happening to something else, someone else. It will never affect me. It's just happening to a few people or to one unfortunate community or to some unlucky individuals. We don't know why. And, you know, there are certain kinds of issues that dwell in those shadows until, you know, something in any of those realms happens to someone to wake them up. It could be that the, you know, one's community gets fracked. It could be that one's child experiences a toxic insult and developmental delays. There's a, you know, a whole bunch of, or, you know, there can be, as what we're going to be discussing on today's show, mental health issues. And, you know, these are all the things that people striving to be successful and functional in a competitive and economically challenged society, you know, are not wanting to really focus on because they, you know, kind of have to survive themselves and get ahead. And so there's a sense of, you know, a way in which we kind of don't look out for all our citizens, but, relegate certain ones to corners and then say, you know, I hope someone's handling it too bad for them. And I see that as, you know, very central to our conversation today about mental health. You know, you will hopefully let us know more about what's really going on in that corner, what has been going on, and what are some of the upcoming proposals for how people with mental health issues need to be supported versus treated versus marginalized, which are some of the social policy options that are now facing people that everyone needs to be better informed about. So for listeners, that's what we're going to be discussing today. So first of all, can you, you know, you've been you know, leading in the mental health advocacy area and working with a group of very impressive organizations that we'll discuss as the show proceeds. But can you, you know, kind of give our listeners some background so people understand, like, you know, are people who are mentally ill just kind of hopeless? Are they to be relegated to a dark corner? Are they a danger to the general public? Can you kind of share with us your, you know, your view of how an average person really needs to regard and hold people who are experiencing mental health issues?
Yes, yeah, thank you so much. This is a great question. And, you know, as you referred to earlier, the personal really is the political. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when we look at mental health and people who have mental health issues or people who've been homeless or, you know, sort of these quote-unquote throwaway populations, there's a lot of very damaging stereotypes that we have in our society that, you know, these are the violent crazies, you know, these people never get better, right? These are some of the misconceptions we hear. You know, maybe some people can get better who have, you know, minor depression or minor anxiety, but people, you know, diagnosed with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, you know, these kind of disorders, they don't get better. And those are really two damaging misconceptions that, you know, the movement that I'm involved in has been trying to fight for at least 40 years, if not longer, to say that, you know, we are people just like you. You know, these things could happen to anyone. We're deserving of human dignity. And we can and do recover our lives. I mean, and, you know, there's my own personal story of recovering my life. I've known many, many dozens, hundreds, thousands of people who've had very severe mental health diagnoses, and with the right support and, you know, people treating them with dignity and respect and honoring, you know, who they are and what they want, they've been able to fully recover a life in the community. You know, these are people who have been institutionalized, you know, told, yeah, you know, the best you can hope for is, you know, just to be stable and stay out of the hospital, you know, but don't really hope for more than that. And we have seen that that is completely untrue, and that, you know, what we really need is a revolution in the way mental health is understood and mental health care and supports and services are delivered that really can facilitate people's ability to recover their lives. And also, you know, we really need to counter these false stereotypes. They're all over the media. You know, whenever one of these horribly tragic, you know, incidents of mass violence happens, people with mental health issues are scapegoated, even though it is commonly understood that across the board, people with mental health issues are no more violent than the general population. In fact, they're more likely to be victims of a crime. And what does raise the potential for violence across all populations is really, really struggling with substance use and how that affects people's judgment. So we're looking at things through the lens of, you know, mental illness is a, you know, causes violence, people can't recover, and we're saying, no, that is untrue. We are just like you, and we do recover, and we do get better.
So people can, in fact, recover. I mean, I've never even kind of heard that mentioned.
Well, yeah, it's a It's not a new concept, but, you know, either we have a PR problem or there's just a lot of other more powerful narratives that are drowning us out. But, you know, since the 90s, you know, it's become more and more mainstream, the concept that people, even with the most severe, you know, mental illness diagnoses, can and do recover. In 2003, in 2003, this concept sort of became official in that it was mentioned in the report of the then President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. You know, right there in the report, people can and do recover. We have a broken system. We need to fix our system to help people recover. But these ideas have not yet filtered fully into mainstream thought and practice, although they are known sort of more narrowly in the mental health field itself.
You know, is there a bifurcation in the field of psychology between people who, you know, maybe clinicians who treat people with, you know, ordinary neurotic problems, you know, wanting to better their lives, issues with family members? There's kind of a continuum between, you know, people who may either be practicing psychotherapists, of which I've had a number on this program, or people who consult them. And where does it kind of move over into what would be classified or thought of as a mental? I mean, those are rarely referred to as a mental health problem. So what are we, where are those lines drawn, and what is the actual continuum in terms of, you know, how people knowledgeable in the mental health field would define that continuum?
Well, you know, I think you're mentioning psychology specifically, but I think there's a big divide in the mental health world in general. You know, I think there's a lot of criticism of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is the publication developed by the American Psychiatric Association to sort of classify all of these different disorders, right? And there's been a lot of controversy over the fact that with every edition, every new edition of the DSM, and there's DSM-5, which is the newest edition, there are more and more things that are classified as disorders. Things such as if you have lost a loved one and you're grieving for, I believe it's more than 2 weeks, that could be, yes, that this can be considered, you know, now it's veered into clinical depression. You know, all different sorts of coping mechanisms that people use to deal with either traumatic experiences or just really having a hard time adjusting to our society are classified as, you know, brain disorders. And so there's a division amongst folks who see that, you know, these are you know, brain disorders primarily, and divorce them from political, economic, and social context. And then there's this whole other camp that says, okay, sure, biology is certainly a part of all of our health, physical, mental, biology is part of who we are as human beings. But to reduce all of these complex matters of human suffering purely to a brain disorder really misses the fact that people live in social, political environments and contexts. And it conveniently depoliticizes human suffering. And I think that's sort of the crux of the issue. It's sort of, you know, whether or not these things are purely medical, purely biological, or if they're more nuanced and more complex than that, which means that our job is much harder than just giving someone a drug to fix their brain disorder.
Is there, as our society becomes, you know, more challenging in a whole in a variety of ways that we kind of constantly talk about here on the show, you know, is there an increase in more advanced levels of disturbance? I mean, is that something that has been noted? Or is there, you know, what are the mental health impacts of, you know, of living in this time for many people?
Well, there's an image that comes to my mind that has stayed with me that kind of goes toward answering your question. So there was a study over 20 years of the global burden of disease. And I think it was, I don't want to get this wrong, but I believe it was the Journal of the I can get you the specific citation for your readers, but there was a study that looked at the global burden of disease over the last 20 years and showed that actually any kind of mental health issues are increasing. Depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, that these things are on the rise. Conversely, if you look at other major public health issues such as HIV/AIDS, over the last 20 years, we've actually seen quite a decline in mortality from this. You know, it's been downgraded from, you know, a disease you're almost certain to die from to a chronically manageable disease that people can live with. So that's, you know, over the last 20 years, we've seen that. The same with cancer, diabetes, all these other physical illnesses, we've seen that the public health approach has worked. But when it comes to mental health and when it comes to suicide, we're not seeing those kinds of decreases in mortality or decreases in disease. In fact, we are seeing an increase, which I argue is because we can't apply a simple medical or biological model to these complex, you know, mental health issues that we can to, for example, HIV/AIDS. You know, it's a physical virus in your body, you know, or other sort of physical health issues that are purely physical health issues, if that makes sense.
So what has been the shift, if you could sort of draw an arc, of the policies and the agencies that are accountable for supporting and treating people with mental health issues? What has been the arc of how the societal supports and agencies and policies have been in place over, say, the last 30 years? And what has been the arc, you know, in the movement over time in terms of, you know, from the past through recent years all the way up to the present in terms of, you know, how we're doing on that front? Are we improving in our capacity to support recovery, to avoid marginalization, to, you know, help people either be on meds if they need them or transition from them, you know, you know, free themselves from addiction? I mean, please add other benchmarks. These are the ones that occur to me. But, you know, how have we been doing and how are we doing on those public policy fronts that you work on?
Well, the impetus for change, you know, if you're talking about 30 or more years ago, really came out of the broader civil rights movement, the women's rights, you know, gay liberation, civil rights, disability rights. All of these social movements that sort of flourished, out of that also came a much smaller social movement that not as many people are aware of, but it's people who had been in the mental health system, which at that time was, you know, extremely draconian. I mean, people would go into institutions and just experience the sort of classic one flew over the cuckoo's nest kind of experience that was just so over the top and told, you know, you will never get out of here. And there were some people who did get out. One of them was Judy Chamberlain, who was really considered to be one of the founders or the mothers of this movement, and wrote a book called On Our Own, Patient-Controlled Alternatives for the Mental Health System, which pointed out, A, all of the horrible abuses that were occurring in these systems and the way people were dehumanized and you know, drugged into oblivion and electroshocked and all of these really just harsh interventions. And also just not treated as people, treated as, you know, patients, which is not a fun role to be in. Nobody wants to have patient be their primary identity, you know. So they point out all these abuses, and then they said, but we need to create our own alternatives, which is about a different way of supporting people. It's relationship-based. It's based on mutuality, the idea that, you know, this person has the right to self-determination. That is a central human desire. Everybody would like to have a measure of control over what happens to them in their lives and decisions that are made about their lives. So it's just it represents a philosophical shift from, you know, these are sick people, you know, who sort of a paternalistic approach. These are sick people who can't help themselves. You know, we need to force help on them, you know, no matter how violent or dehumanizing it is, to this idea that, no, there is another way. There is another way to do this, to meet the needs of people who are suffering deeply, people in crisis, people who are suicidal, people who are homeless, people who hear voices. And so out of this came this beautiful international movement of people, we say, with lived experience or people who've been there, who've heard voices, who've had all these experiences and are talking about let's make sense of these in a different way. And that there is the power of people who have been there, sometimes referred to as peers. These peers can support one another and, you know, help each other to navigate the way out of madness, to navigate through complex and difficult human service systems. And it's this beautiful mutual relationship that's not, you know, based so much on hierarchies and power imbalance, you know, doctor, patient, you know, that kind of thing, where it's an authority figure telling you what's good for you versus someone who says, hey, I've been where you are and I've found a way out. Like, let's figure out how you can find your way out. Let's figure that out together. What do you need to achieve the life that you want and to feel better?
That's so interesting because, you know, I mean, that's a very fascinating perspective for two reasons. A, I must confess to ignorance and that I was entirely unaware of, you know, the potential for discovery through peer nurturance and support that you're describing. I was just entirely unaware of the efficacy of that. And also, I'm noting in, you know, so that's pretty astounding and very eye-opening because the portrait has been that these kinds of ailments are intractable, you know.
Right.
And it's kind of like anything that falls outside a particular pale, you know, can't be treated or no one will recover from. You know, ordinary psychotherapy is less helpful. So, you know, hence the drugging and into submission and all the rest of it. The other piece of it that I find interesting is that, you know, in the international kind of community looking at economic and environmental solutions, there is an extensive and, you know, looking at it, less hierarchical, co-opted work ways of working and building infrastructures and cooperating and working together, you know, there is this peer-to-peer movement, and it's so fascinating to hear that really this is what you're describing as an approach in the mental health field. The other thing that comes to mind for me is that the kind of, you know, on the furthest end of the spectrum, under the hierarchical approach, you know, the approach of an authoritarian expert or, you know, an expert in authority, you know, on the far end of it, you have people prescribing drugs. But you can also, you know, have it in all kinds of ways where people, you know, want to follow a particular kind of leader, you know, they want to, you know, kind of abdicate a certain level of their own self-determination in order to have that comfort level or participate. So, you know, obviously when the end stage gets to being, you know, you're going to have to take these drugs for the rest of your life, you know, we could kind of see that, you know, how untenable that is. And certainly there are more benevolent forms of leadership or hierarchy, but you're also, you know, you're also, you know, you're also really articulating a critique of, you know, of this hierarchical approach to healing. And I don't always hear that. I hear, you know, people looking up to yoga teachers, having someone tell them what to eat. You know, I mean, obviously some people do need, you need to learn yoga from someone who knows it. You need to learn, you know, get the right ideas about what to eat. But there's a lot of that kind of abdication going on. And people kind of take it for granted and, you know, accept it if, you know, what's being offered is obviously less benign than a psychotic, you know, an antipsychotic medication. Is there a particular reason that this critique comes out of the mental health field, I'm wondering?
Well, you know, I think it just has to do with the fact that, you know, people who've received these services are rising up and saying what you're doing is not working. And, and we certainly, you know, it's really taken this sort of push from people who've been on the receiving end. And nobody is saying that, you know, if you find your medication helpful, you know, that, you know, that's, there's, we support anybody doing anything that they need to for their mental health. But part of the issue is that these treatments, you know, frankly, particularly antipsychotic drugs, that these quote-unquote treatments are actually killing people. And there was a study that came out through the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors that said that people who are diagnosed with severe mental illness die on average 25 years younger than the general population. So there's a very important a level of awareness that needs to happen there, is that the antipsychotic medications, when they're, you know, prescribed in high doses in combination with many other drugs, which is called polypharmacy, and this is a very widespread practice that they just kind of throw the kitchen sink at people and put them on six different drugs. And I can say that was the experience of both of my parents, who were diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, that they were both on many drugs. My father would sleep, you know, 18 hours a day. He was so drugged. And both of them ended up dying quite young. So we need to just really raise awareness about informed consent, because people are not being told when they are prescribed these medications. They're really not being apprised of the full level of risk that they can cause massive weight gain, lead to diabetes, cause metabolic syndrome, and truly cause people to die. So there's something really wrong with drugs that, you know, may dull people's voices but will actually kill them. And I don't think that the risks in all of these cases, the benefits outweigh the risks. So there's a very important piece to hear about informed consent. And then the other piece is that if people are prescribed these drugs, there's very little willingness in the mental health field to help them reduce or withdraw from the drugs. So we are trying to say we need good information. A lot of people will go off their medications cold turkey because they don't like the way they make them feel. They're very troubled by the side effects. And then they, you know, experience a whole host of problems and don't realize that it's because they, you know, took themselves cold turkey off a medication. That we need to be sharing information about how to safely, very safely withdraw or reduce, you know, if that is the person's desire. And again, it just comes back to this attitude of, you know, we're people who've been through this. We know what helps. We know what hurts. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to healing. Some people really benefit from being on a low dose of a medication. Some people absolutely do not benefit at all, and that we can't come at this with a singular, you know, one-size-fits-all approach. Hope that answered your question.
Yes, no, it's a terrific answer. And I just want to ask one tiny follow-up, and then we'll go into our station identification break, which is, you know, one of the things that I guess is coming to my own consciousness in terms of my own misbegotten attitudes and belief, is there is almost an unstated assumption that anybody with a mental health issue is incapacitated and therefore from making any kind of solid determination for their own benefit. So it's almost as if due to having that mental health issue, they you know, are kind of, it's assumed they've abdicated and that they could never, you know, kind of figure it out for themselves or maybe even understand what's involved. So, you know, right away that's a removal of self-determination, yet I think that many people would tend to believe that this is beneficent because they would just simply be incapable of making decisions on their own behalf. What is the, you know, truth of that? Or, you know, what are the variations on that theme?
Yeah, I mean, I think C.S. Lewis said something like some of the worst tyrannies are those, you know, exercised for the good of their own victims. Or I forget exactly how it goes. But yeah, so basically, yes, certainly, you know, my mother at times was in an altered state where, you know, she thought the Nazis were poisoning the food supply and was not in a consensus reality with the rest of us, you know. And there are certainly people when they have been in crisis, when they've been struggling for a long time, when they hear voices, do tend to sometimes be in a reality that's different than the rest of us. However, there have been a lot of people who have worked on the International Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and they have addressed this issue of capacity on a human rights level, saying that regardless, of whatever one's state is, there are forms and models of supported decision making where you can work with that person wherever they are and still preserve their dignity. Because I will say, self-determination is a basic human need. You see it in small children. I mean, and you see it in elders. who want to remain independent. This is part of who we are as people. We cherish our self-determination, and that's part of our dignity. So the international human rights viewpoint says that we don't have to take dignity and rights away from people, that there are ways of working with people. There are ways of relating to people who may be hearing voices or who may not be in consensus reality or experiencing extreme states, where you can find out what they want. I mean, if anyone had talked to my mother and said, why do you, you know, instead of saying, oh, that's a delusion, the Nazis aren't poisoning the food supply, your doctor isn't Dr. Mengele, you know, you're deluded. When you sort of just, you know, say, you're, you know, this person's delusional and there's no truth in their delusions, you miss valuable information about that human being. Instead of saying, wow, that must be really frightening. Like, what makes you feel that way? You know, and she would have had a lot to say about how she was treated in mental health systems, how she was treated by her psychiatrist, you know, being abused and put in things like seclusion and restraint, which are very, very damaging to the human spirit. So there are ways to work with people whose capacity may not be what yours and mine is, and help them get to the place where they can be ever more active participant in their own lives. And this dovetails very nicely with the Affordable Care Act and the push towards, you know, person-centered care. It's that this is about this person. It's not about doing things to people. It's about being with people.
Fascinating. Thank you. This is really interesting. Very, very provocative way to look at this. We are going to take a break now here in Connect the Dots from speaking with Leah Harris, a mental health advocate and educator. And we will, after a brief station identification, we'll be returning to the show for more about some of the upcoming public policies that are kind of proposed for this sector, how they affect not only people with mental illness, but also all of us potentially. So stay with us for the second half of the show. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On today's show, we're discussing mental health issues, policies, and attitudes that we have about people suffering from mental health illnesses, as well as the different treatment approaches and philosophies as to how they can be treated, recover, you know, treat themselves and recover, and the right context for creating that. So that's the theme of today's show. We're talking with mental health advocate Leah Harris. And very interesting first half of the show. If you're just tuning in, please, you may want to hear the second half in the Connect the Dots archive. And anyone listening to the show that finds this of interest, as I certainly am, I think it's raising a number of important issues that go to a broader spectrum of concern than, you know, the average person may be aware of, then please do pass this show along to others who may be interested, as well as liking us on iTunes. And now we're returning to my conversation with Leah Harris. So, Leah, we talked a little bit about the background health context and then got involved in talking a bit about really the treatment philosophy and the potential for greater recovery in the context and approaches that really facilitate that, as well as the human rights dimension of how people with mental health illnesses are treated. So, you know, I think all of that is really important. What I'd love to hear now is, I'm aware that there are some, and I think our listeners may not have heard of this because it was relatively new to me as well. You know, there are some new proposals on, you know, kind of on the calendar for our federal legislators in terms of treatment approaches, restrictions and rights infringements potentially in the mental health arena. Could you update our listeners about these current developments?
Yeah, absolutely. But first, just really briefly, I wanted to give the citation for the study that I mentioned earlier in the show about the burden of diseases. It was by the Journal of the American Medical Association called The State of U.S. Health 1990 to 2010. So please check out that study to see how, you know, mental health related disability is on the rise. So yeah, to answer your question, basically, in coming out of the tragedies that happened at Newtown, as well as many of the other tragedies that have gripped our nation, there is an understanding that we need to really address, you know, mental health. And so there was, there's a representative named Representative Tim Murphy out of Pennsylvania who in December of last year sponsored a bill called the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act of 2013. And, of course, to hear the title, anyone say, well, this sounds great. I mean, who doesn't want to help families in mental health crisis? Certainly, he's very good at identifying what the problems are. Obviously, people are not able to access the kind of support that they want and need. You know, people are rotting in prison who are really, you know, struggling with mental health issues. There are, you know, people who experience homelessness and are just alone on the street with no resources and support. You know, these are all very serious social issues, and nobody would argue that that these are not worth the, you know, deep attention. However, the solutions that he poses in this legislation, and he's really taking his cue from some very extreme people who believe that, you know, really people must be forced into treatment because they lack insight into their illness. You know, so it's a very extreme paternalistic perspective that is not reflective of what we're really trying to accomplish in terms of the direction of healthcare. So he's getting his cue, you know, from these kind of extreme folks, and so he's proposing a lot of really frightening kinds of solutions that are very much counter to the ideals of people with disabilities. He wants to definitely expand the practice of, they call it assisted outpatient treatment, is the euphemism, but it's actually called involuntary outpatient commitment, which basically is, if people are in crisis and for whatever reason don't want to comply with their treatment, and people generally don't ask them why they don't want to comply, but if they don't want to comply with their treatment, they are then court-ordered to accept treatment against their will, and that includes medications that they may or not agree that they want to take. It may be other treatments that they may or may not want to do. You know, and then the other issue is that, you know, force and coercion in mental health care really do drive people away from treatment. This has been well discussed in psychiatric services and other, you know, major publications. You know, other things is he wants to reduce privacy for people in the mental health system. We already have health, you know, information protection laws, HIPAA, that allows people to designate you know, who has access to their private information and their health records. And Mr. Murphy would, you know, definitely break down a lot of those privacy issues. Who's determining what's studied, what's evaluated, what's funded, what becomes an evidence-based evidence-based practice, and what is not? It reflects a very narrow scientific, you know, almost sort of worshiping a scientific approach rather than a sort of human service, social justice approach, right, and really enshrining this authoritarian medical approach into legislation. And it would reward states who promote these kinds of coercive and traumatizing interventions at the expense of providing real, voluntary, accessible community options for people. So that's what we're fighting. We're fighting to keep our self-determination, you know, right to choose what kind of treatment that we feel would be helpful for us, access to treatment that we want or treatment or services or support. You know, there is a huge issue where people can't get what they need, and then other people are forced to, you know, accept interventions that they don't want. What's wrong with this picture? So everyone agrees that the system is broken. But Mr. Murphy and his legislation would really take us back to a much, much less progressive time. And so that's, we're sort of fighting for really privacy and liberty and access to what we need to get better.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is certainly, you know, this whole discussion of what is evidence-based or what is science, you know, as a, is actually occurring in many dimensions. And it's one, you know, that I've brought up ad nauseum to my listeners, but it bears mentioning again because you bring it up now, and we see it here again in this context. As a longtime health and science reporter, I have tremendous regard for science. But really, as you state, it's very important to understand that there are there is a selectivity. And often agendas, economic agendas, business agendas, all kinds of institutional agendas that really enter into which treatments get studied and which don't, which
exactly.
things are studied to determine if they're safe, mm-hmm. and which are kind of given a free pass. So, you know, if, you know, when we say the word science, we're expecting, you know, there's an assumption that goes in that world that it's a kind of neutral, you know, sort of pure land where none of these other factors could possibly enter in, and yet really the context in which science is undertaken and done really obviates that, and it's really not true at all that you know that's what's occurring. And so here again we see it here, and in every area where I've looked into it, you know, there are agendas, conflicts of interest. It's not that there isn't you know, any good science out there, or it's not that the scientific method does not have value, but it's being applied by humans and you know, in all sorts of contexts, and it's important to remember mm-hmm. that. I mean, one of the things, so I see it again operating here, one of the things though that you know, that I keep coming up against is my own prejudice, actually, very likely. But, you know, the sense that, you know, the real, I think it's, you know, and I often write about how we get kind of enlisted in certain cultural assumptions that, you know, may or may not be true. And I find myself continually, you know, coming back to the question of, and, you know, how can mental health people with mental health issues really make decisions? Like, is there a continuum on their capacity to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly there's a continuum, and you know, mm-hmm. as I said earlier, I recognize that there are times when people go into altered states where, you know, it's not possible to carry on a conversation in the same way that you and I are right now to say, what, you know, mm-hmm. what kind of treatments would you like? What are your mm-hmm. what are your goals? You know, I mean, yeah,
right.
That's nobody's arguing with that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're trying to say is that to force interventions on people is not the way that we want to progress in our healthcare. I'll give you an example. I'm a
yep.
facilitator for a training called emotional CPR. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, if we were to practice things like emotional CPR, which really teaches skills of how to interact respectfully with people in crisis and preserve their dignity,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, that kind of thing actually helps people to get to the place where they can shift out of the crisis and come back into consensus reality. You know, let's say someone is not talking. That's a big one. Someone's
mm-hmm.
not talking. They're sort of slumped in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional CPR would say, instead of trying to force them to talk, you know, and force them to interact, that you would be with the person
mm-hmm.
in a quiet, you know, match their body language, match, you know, what they're doing. Just be with them. And sometimes
mm-hmm.
it takes a long time. It's not as easy as just, you know, medicating someone into oblivion. That's a simple, you know, approach.
Mm.
This approach recognizes the prevalence of trauma in people's lives and that people have been traumatized and to further, you know, traumatize them through, you know, taking away their dignity and humanity is not the way we want to go. And there are other examples. There's a great program coming out of Finland called Open Dialogue that works with young people who are experiencing what they call first break psychosis, which we see is very common transition for people entering adulthood. Mm-hmm. Making that transition from childhood to adulthood can cause some people to go into these states. And so Open Dialogue is an approach that it works collectively and collaboratively with the young person, with their family, with whatever other supports, friends or natural supports, you know, that are involved in that individual's life. So it's very holistic. It's not just looking at one person in isolation from everything else. Mm-hmm. And they have unbelievable recovery rates. I mean, something like 80 to 85% of people who go through Open Dialogue go on to, you know, pursue education, you know, get into the workforce, you know, be meaningfully involved in their communities, and generally do not go back into psychosis again. Mm-hmm. So we can really show that when we encounter someone at that very delicate first break, how we treat them in that moment is very essential to you know, whether there will be a negative outcome of increased disability and illness or a positive outcome in terms of recovery, self-determination, dignity, and then that person being able to regain a life in the community. So, you know, I think very much this is about prevention. Mm-hmm. And that we need to not be so crisis-oriented and stabilization-oriented. Our whole system is predicated on crisis and stabilization, crisis and stabilization. We need to break out of that and move into, let's look at prevention. And then, you know, for people who are, you know, maybe in a bona fide crisis, you know, to look at changing the way we interact with them to help them to come out of that shell. You know, Daniel Fisher, who I'm very influenced by, he's a psychiatrist who himself recovered from schizophrenia, talks about how people get trapped in monologue in their own head, mm-hmm. you know, and that's so often what psychosis is. It's like this monologue that runs and runs and runs in someone's head. And
right.
through these practicing these relationship techniques of just being with a person, you can help them break out of that monologue and then enter into a dialogue, and then they can discover, you know, their own solutions, you know, in the context of a supportive community that respects their dignity.
Mm-hmm. So actually being in that kind of monologue is, so do you use meditative techniques, or what is it that is helpful in those kind of situations?
Well, you know, there's no one thing that works for everyone. And mm-hmm. for some people, you know, they might temporarily, you know, benefit by being on a very low dose of a medication there temporarily mm-hmm. just to kind of help them cope with the intensity of the experience. Mm-hmm. But with Open Dialogue, it's understood that this is a temporary thing, that they do not need to be on heavy duty, disabling dosages of drugs for the rest of their lives. It's like, this is mm-hmm. just for a little while.
Mm-hmm,
that can sort of help people, you know, get to the place where they can, you know, get some skills. So there's been things called hearing voices groups that can be very helpful. This came out of Great Britain, and this is people who've heard voices helping other people to learn how to cope with their voices, how to make sense of their voices, to understand where the voices came from, which is overwhelmingly tends to be out of a deeply traumatic experience of some kind of abuse in their lives. So, you know, through these kinds of self-help groups, people have found those extremely helpful in regaining control over distressing voices. You know, there's just so many different approaches, and, you know, I would never want to say that, you know, medication is for everyone or meditation is for everyone, but mm-hmm. there's so many holistic approaches looking at nutrition. A lot mm-hmm. of people diagnosed with schizophrenia have extreme sensitivities to gluten, you know, processed foods, and if you look at what they serve people in hospitals, it's like, you know, the worst unhealthy junk generally, mm-hmm. you know, that is not going to serve a person's total healing. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not easy. There's no, you know, we want to say, you know, medicate and hospitalize, and, you know, and that's the approach, but that's a one-size-fits-all approach that is not going to be the answer for every person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can really, I can really understand that. That makes a lot of sense. Why is it, you're mentioning the transition to adulthood is a particularly sensitive time. Why is that?
I mean, there's a lot of theories as to why that is so, and I'll admit it's not my particular expertise, but I think a lot of it does have to do, you know, when young people go off to college and they're separated for the first time from their, you know, traditional family, friends, and support networks. Some people are, you know, particularly vulnerable in those situations, and there's a lot of pressure in the university setting, and I think that's why we see so many huge mental health issues, you know, flaring up when young people enter college. And that's just one example, but I think also it's that, you know, we just don't provide enough support for people as they're going through big life transitions like leaving your family of origin and taking on a new role. You know, universities have typically, you know, been at a loss outside of the you know, standard counseling system as to really how to support people, you know, who may be vulnerable to distress, you know, in the transition. But, yeah, there's a lot of studies of the Soteria model, which is another idea of non-coercive, very much relationship-based working with people who have, you know, experiences of psychosis. And a lot of the Soteria literature, you know, talks about you know, complex reasons as to why this might be the case for people, but often even more than the reasons is sort of how, again, comes back to how do we relate to people as they're going through the experiences is really what makes all the difference. How do we interact? What are our assumptions?
What would be the keynotes of you know, of that? What would be the keynotes for relating to people?
The keynotes are, number one, don't make assumptions about a person's experience. You know, that somebody, just because somebody, you know, is hearing voices or is diagnosed with schizophrenia, kind of going back to what we said originally, the assumption is, oh, you know, wow, if you got that stuff, oh, okay, well, you know, yeah, we're just going to give you a prescription and, you know, get you all set up on disability, and this is pretty much what's going to be happening for you in your life. Versus if you come into this, the assumptions that we carry matter so much because they color the way we behave. If you come into it thinking like, wow, okay, this is a person who's really suffering, it's very likely they've experienced trauma. We assume trauma. 85% of the people in the mental health system have experienced trauma. I mean, the statistics are just overwhelming. You know, people with substance use overwhelmingly report sexual abuse or violence. You know, people in jail diversion programs, 95% of women have experienced physical or sexual abuse. You know, I mean, I could go on and on and on. You know, so we assume that a person has experienced trauma. And when you assume that, rather than that they're diseased or disordered, we you know, assume that they are a suffering person who's been through some difficult experiences, we then have much more compassion. And that compassion really is the keynote, that compassion and that the sense that, you know, this person's dignity must be honored. You know, above all else, you know, above all else, do no harm. You know, and those are the kinds of keynotes. Meet people where they're at. Don't judge. Don't label. Don't fall into negative stereotypes.
Honor this is that really this is very an individual. Important stuff. Yeah, honoring the individual. We're coming to the end of our show, but I think these are keynotes for all of healthcare. And Leah Harris, you're reminding us that we, you know, that those extend to people with mental health illness. Thank you so much for the terrific work you're doing and for being on this show. And I want to let our listeners know that they can catch up with your writings and your work at your website, LeahIdaHarris.com. That's LeahIdaHarris.com. Look for blogs, excerpts for her upcoming book. Leah also has blogs and articles on MadInAmerica.com, which is another website that explores these issues in great depth and also has information about upcoming mental health bills and policy actions that people can take. Thank you so much, Leah, for being with me today on Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks to you and Mary Ellen.
That's right. Happy birthday again, Mary Ellen. And thank you, listeners, for being with us this week. Another edition of Connect the Dots will be coming to you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and have a great and healthy week.